Evan Young, it's here and now, and we've been keeping an eye on two hearings today on Capitol Hill. Later, we'll hear how the House voted for subpoena power in the fired prosecutor's case. But first, former Vice President Al Gore is on Capitol Hill today testifying about global warming. In a House hearing, Gore challenged Congress to make the U.S. the global leader on fighting climate change, and he warned lawmakers if they don't take action, one day the next generation will ask why.
They will ask, what in God's name were they doing? Didn't they see the evidence? Didn't they realize that four times in 15 years, the entire scientific community of this world issued unanimous reports calling upon them to act? What was wrong with them?
Gore had a laundry list of suggestions for Congress, including a ban on new coal-fired power plants that don't trap their carbon emissions. He also called for a new way of viewing the electric grid, comparing it to the internet. He said people should be able to make their own electricity and sell it back to electric companies. Well, John Donnelly is covering today's hearings for the Boston Globe. He joins us now. And John, overall, how was the former vice president received?
I think he was received quite warmly by most of the members, even a number of the Republicans. When he went up to meet the chairman, Representative Dingell, Representative Dingell said to him, "Welcome home." So it was that kind of an atmosphere
right there.
He
was challenged, though, in particular from Republican Congressman Joe Barton of Texas, who debated many of Gore's claims. We know that in the past week, in a New York Times report in particular, several mainstream scientists who say they agree with the theories that there is global warming and that humans and carbon emissions are causing that global warming, that they said they felt that Al Gore might have been sensationalizing some of these claims. That conversation happened, and Joe Barton seemed to be having that in mind. Let's hear some of his challenges of Al Gore.
You've also asserted that global warming is going to cause sea levels to rise by over 20 feet. 20 feet. The recent IPCC report indicates a rise of at most 23 inches. Inches. 12 inches equals a foot. You state that there will be more and stronger hurricanes because of global warming. The IPCC report does not support this claim. You've also stated that malaria has been exacerbated in Nairobi because of global warming. The World Health Organization report does not support this allegation.
John Donnelly, how did Al Gore respond?
Well, he responded. He didn't respond directly to the sea level rise, but he responded about the hurricanes, that actually any hurricane can't be traced to global warming, but that the intensity of hurricanes will be greater. He also didn't address malaria. There were a couple of tough moments with Representative Barton and a couple of others, because clearly, you know, the science is never going to be 100% on this. But what Gore was arguing mostly was that the consensus of scientific argument is with him, the vast consensus.
Yeah. Well, let's listen to how Al Gore responded to a challenge about carbon emissions, and especially carbon emissions that were produced by humans in their cars and elsewhere, causing global warming. Let's listen.
The planet has a fever. If your baby has a fever, you go to the doctor. If the doctor says you need to intervene here, you don't say, well, I read a science fiction novel that tells me it's not a problem. If the crib's on fire, you don't speculate that the baby is flame retardant. You take action. The planet has a fever.
John Donnelly, Al Gore is going to be speaking before a Senate committee tomorrow. I mean, what is the general sense of the conversation in Washington? Is it, you know, that we're debating whether or not there is global warming and humans cause it, or we're talking about what to do?
I think it's the latter. I think, you know, that today, so far in the hearing today, there were even a number of Republicans, including the former Speaker of the House, Denny Hastert, who said, you know, I basically agree with you on a number of these solutions that you have. So I think the conversation's changing a bit. There will be some definitely more tense moments this afternoon with Senator Inhofe in the Senate hearing, where he has said in the past that global warming is a hoax. But I think you have to listen to the whole conversation. The whole conversation, even in the last couple of months, has changed much more to Al Gore's position.
Yeah. Well, what were some of the other things that he suggested? He had quite a laundry list, some we've heard of, you know, banning incandescent light bulbs, raising the CAFE standards, you know, mile per gallon that a car can achieve. But what were some of those that maybe were newer to people?
Well, one of them that was kind of interesting was actually allowing people to produce their own energy sources off the electric grid by having solar or wind, and getting thousands and thousands of people to do this off the grid and then sell it back to the grid, so that you have, you know, not going to be a huge amount of electricity, but you have people contributing to it and actually making money off of it.
Yeah. He also suggested start using the tax code to reduce taxes on people who aren't polluting and raise taxes on people who are.
Right. That's also going to be a big discussion here in the future. And he also said to that is that you have to be very careful in not hurting people who are poor.
Yeah. John Donnelly, covering today's hearings for the Boston Globe, as former Vice President Al Gore, who left Washington in defeat, now returns as a spokesperson for the global warming movement, testifies before Congress today. John, thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
This past Sunday's South Boston St. Patrick's Day Parade traveled through a community that has changed quite a bit. A sushi bar stands where a mob-related tavern once saw a lot of murders. The sun-drenched oceanfront houses are being snapped up by outsiders. Mob boss Whitey Bulger is on the run, replaced by the fictional version in the film The Departed. And the old Broadway Bridge, which once attached this peninsula to the mainland, has been renovated.
Crossing this bridge, I always talk about how I was kind of straddling two worlds.
Author Michael Patrick McDonald took us on a car tour of his old stomping grounds. He grew up the youngest of 11 in the old colony housing projects. If South Boston was insulated, the projects felt barricaded, keeping outsiders out, but Southie residents in. One brother was mentally ill and committed suicide. Two others died in violent acts. Michael's written a book about how he escaped through punk rock.
I start Easter Rising by giving the first answer to the question, how did you get out of the neighborhood? And the first answer is that I was really good sneaking on trains, even before I eventually broke away into the music world. We would follow my brother Kevin around on shoplifting ventures into the downtown area of Boston. And my brother Kevin, he ended up dying at the age of 22 from being involved in the streets. He had snuck out of the neighborhood with me on those same trains, but he wasn't as interested as I was in seeing that bigger world out there beyond the neighborhood.
Well, in effect, punk didn't hook him the way it hooked you, and that...
Right. Even my brother Frankie, who was a Golden Gloves champion boxer, was kind of a neighborhood hero, athlete. He ended up dying in an armored car heist at the age of 23. He had been exposed to the punk world because he was a bouncer at the most important punk club in Boston, at the Rathskeller. I was embracing all of that difference, and he was obsessed with the kind of South Boston conformity.
Your grandfather breaks my heart in the book. I mean, he cares so much. He's trying so hard to connect and hold the family
right.
together. And say nothing to nobody. That was the code of the housing project you lived in, something mm-hmm. your grandfather said. And punk seemed to be the opposite of that.
Right. Kind of. I always think of it as kind of like sounding the alarm. Things aren't right, and I feel uneasy.
I'm in distress. I need to confess. What do I get?
Okay, so here's the Paradise Club, which is on Comm Ave. It's sort of the Boston University area. What are memories from this club?
Well, I used to hang out in front of here when I was 13 and 14, 15. Sometimes you'd hang out by the back door and wait for the bands to be coming through and ask them if you could carry a piece of equipment. You discover at some point that, you know, you can kind of get through anything by just pretending like you own the place. And we did that a lot. And one time I walked out on stage and ended up on stage while Susie from Susie and the Banshees was beginning her performance.
What was that like, walking around like you own the paradise, and then going back home at night? It felt almost like your carriage turned back into a pumpkin.
Well, I discovered a world where I was very much in control of who I was going to be. Whereas back in South Boston, back at home, back in the Old Colony Project, I kind of felt much more powerless and felt like I was just, witnessing things that I had no control over. A lot of the chaos and the violence and the drug abuse, the drug trade that was controlled by organized crime and the Irish Mafia. We all knew that Whitey Bulger would make someone disappear in a heartbeat. Kids died. So many young people died. And to think that in a community like that, that the male leadership would ever look the other way and ignore that Whitey Bulger was taking the lives of our young people and poisoning so many young people with the cocaine he flooded the streets with. It's just unimaginable. Now, as a grown man, it's unimaginable that anybody could look the other way when that's happening to kids. You felt, in South Boston, I think a lot of, young people in that period of time felt disempowered, and especially if you're from the housing project. It was a big, big difference to be from the housing project than to be from another part of more politically connected South Boston. So it was really a feeling of powerlessness. In the punk rock world, where we were kids basically taking over the world.
What was some of the music? Tick off the songs that, it sounds like it opened a window for you.
Yeah, it was some of the earliest stuff I listened to. People like Patti Smith would refer you to books and art and historic movements. Here I am living in a white housing project. We have so much black poverty in Boston and so much white poverty, and both sides are at each other's throats. But you don't have the language to really understand all of that, because in this country, we don't use the word class. We talk about race, but we don't talk about class. And so then you have a band like The Clash, whose politics are all about class, and that helped me to make a lot of sense of what I had been seeing.
You were escaping Sister Sledge's We Are Family.
And Good Times by Chic, which was, that was the anthem that was out the year my brother Davey jumped off the roof, which was something I witnessed. So it was at that time, you witnessed these kinds of horrors, and the hit song of the era is Good Times. That's just hard to live with. So, you break out and you discover Richard Hell and the Voidoids singing I Belong to the Blank Generation, or Iggy and the Stooges singing Search and Destroy, and that makes a lot more sense.
That's author Michael Patrick McDonald on his salvation through punk rock. He lost two brothers to violence. The family's convinced one was killed by mob boss Whitey Bulger. A schizophrenic brother jumped off a roof, a sister fell off a roof and into a coma. Michael would return to South Boston to be a community activist. He'd return also to his Irish roots. We'll hear about that after the break, here and now. It's Here and Now, and we're back to continue our car tour of South Boston here outside Boston, Massachusetts, with author Michael Patrick McDonald. In his memoir, Easter Rising, he tells how punk rock, ironically so feared as something dangerous by people in his South Boston housing project, saved him from drugs and violence, actually sent him to the library.
I always had to look stuff up. You hear a Mitchell and Burma song, Max Ernst, and I'd have to go look up Max Ernst, and then through him discovered the whole Dada movement.
Describe some of the ways you dress, and then how did people back home think about that?
The look was, just imagine Farrah Fawcett Majors and Barry Manilow. So anybody with even just hair sticking up all over the place was just, the whole bus would break out into laughter when they saw that. And that's what we wanted. We were looking to shake things up. Everybody kind of had their own shtick, And mine was kind of like emulating a lot of the homeless people I'd see walking over the Broadway Bridge. And a lot of the mental institute patients of the time at Mass Mental, where my brother Davey had been. And it was in the aftermath of my brother Davey's suicide that I crossed the Broadway Bridge and found this bigger world and this whole scene of misfits and outsiders. And I didn't realize this until I was writing the book, that in a lot of ways, the look that I was taking on was not unlike Davey and a lot of his friends from Mass Mental, or a lot of the people he was friends with from the Pine Street Inn. I mean,
that's the homeless shelter. Kind of, do you think that was your way of not letting Davey go?
In a way, I think I was like getting closer to Davey by being close, by taking part in this intentionally proud misfit and outsider culture. One of the things I write about in Easter Rising is discovering that a lot of these people, like Patti Smith, are expressing things that Davey expressed, but Davey was locked up for expressing.
Across the country, through the fields, you know I see it written across the sky. People rising on the highway, in world wars they find a track, and it's wild, 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 wild.
When my brother Frankie and Kevin died a few years later, in the aftermath of their deaths, my guilt brought me back home in a totally opposite way. I became obsessed with being home, with looking quote-unquote normal and looking like everybody else in Southie and trying to become part of the neighborhood in order to kind of get closer to them by being in this place that they loved, Southie, and that they lived for and that they ultimately died for. You know, it was this neighborhood, the lower end of Southie, the three census tracts in the lower end were found to have had the highest concentration of white poverty in America. There are all the problems that come with poverty anywhere. But then on top of that, being in this place where, whether because of organized crimes, code of silence, or just the cultural stuff, being a very Irish-American neighborhood, the kind of hush-hush ways of Irish-American culture of not wanting to reveal any kind of weakness. And then there's the whole thing that goes with white poverty, where you're kind of not, you know, it's not really acknowledged very much in this country. And South Boston was always kind of relegated to a place of no sympathy ever since busing. The entire population and all the kids of the neighborhood lost out in a lot of ways because those borders were fortified. And they were fortified by our own corrupt politicians and gangsters, as well as the outside world's perceptions of us. You know, when people ask me, how did you get out of Southie? You know, usually they wanted an answer that deals with, you know, I studied hard and pulled myself up by my bootstraps and got a degree and ended up with a PhD and so on and so forth. And that's a great route for some people to take. But the honest answer was that when I was 13 years old, I walked over that bridge and I discovered punk rock. For me, it's not important that I got out as much as it is important that I came back and was able to embrace everything about where I come from. And that includes South Boston. It includes the class that I come from. It includes, you know, Ireland eventually, ultimately. Because with rejecting South Boston and rejecting my family that came with that whole kind of punk subculture, I rejected all things Irish. I rejected the entire heritage. I associated it all with a lot of the bigotry that I was running from in the neighborhood, a lot of the racist violence that had happened through the busing years. And when I went to Ireland, all of that changed for me.
You discovered a people who embraced African Americans, in particular the Irish did, because they identified with them.
Right. I found from my cousins over there that there was a lot more identification with African American struggles than there was with anything Irish American, because people in the North, especially or close to the borders, were very aware that Catholics in the North had experienced what African Americans experienced in this country. My childhood here, before I became a teenager, I loved being part of this extended family. When my brother Davey jumped off the roof, I had to get away from home as much as possible. I couldn't stand what it was that I was feeling when I would see the faces of my siblings who had also lost my brother Davey. It was out of grief that I had to break away. But really, once I broke away, I started to see how the neighborhood kind of felt like a cult. What thrills me is that I can go to the South Bronx and a 15-year-old Puerto Rican kid from the housing projects there will tell me, you told my story. I want none of it to be isolated to being about the neighborhood of South Boston. I want everyone to know that there's a neighborhood just like this down the street from you, wherever you are in this country. And if there were one song of the period that might encapsulate what it is that I still would, to this day, acknowledge about that story, it's the song, Mission of Burma song, That's How I Escaped My Certain Fate, when I was writing this book, I realized that I had truly escaped something that could have been certain, that young death from violence and drug overdoses. And through the music, I escaped that fate.
Author Michael Patrick McDonald, his two books are Easter Rising and All Souls. Well, quick look at tomorrow on Here and Now. We'll go on another trip. A son takes his Marine father back to Vietnam to try to understand why war is the father of all things. That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, we'll tell you what happened today in that battle between the White House and lawmakers over the prosecutor firing story. Here's a hint. One side now has subpoenas. We'll tell you more after the news, Here and Now. Support. It's Here and Now. Democrats are following through with promises to force White House officials to testify under oath and in public about the firing of 8 federal prosecutors last year. This morning, a House Judiciary Subcommittee gave the green light to subpoenas, which could demand testimony and documents from the president's one-time lawyer, Harriet Myers, political advisor Karl Rove, and other White House officials. Committee Chair John Conyers of Michigan, a Democrat, was pressed by Republicans on the committee about whether he would use these subpoenas and if this was a political witch hunt.
Trust me, committee, we are not going to move in a reckless or angry or temperamental way at all.
This all started when President Bush threw down the gauntlet yesterday and said he'd absolutely go to court and fight any subpoenas on the grounds of protecting the privacy of advice given to him. So what happens now? Well, joining us on the line, Jonathan Turley, professor at George Washington University Law School. And Jonathan, put this in context for us. First of all, are you surprised about today's subpoena vote?
No, I'm not. I think this was almost as predictable as the president drawing that sand in the line last night.
You mean line in the sand, but that's okay. That's all right. We understand. So the Congress now has subpoena power. They haven't invoked it. The president has executive privilege. Now, remind us how that works.
Well, executive privilege is actually not mentioned in the Constitution. It's a creation of the courts. And for that reason, presidents have in the past avoided court fights in the fear that they could result in a reduction of executive privilege. In that sense, what the president said last night really might not be as persuasive to his successors when he says, I'm doing this for future presidents. You know, when you want to protect the executive privilege, you only go into court with the strongest possible case because it is so fragile.
Well, let's back up a minute. If, in fact, these aides are served with subpoenas, has the president said that he would invoke executive privilege? And what does that mean? Does that mean that he can say they don't have to testify?
Well, it sure sounds like he's prepared to do that. He told the reporters that this was his last and best offer and that he's prepared to go to the mat on this.
Mm-hmm.
That's all language that would indicate that he would go to court. What would happen logistically is that the subpoenas would be issued. They would refuse to appear. And then the committee, not just the House committee, but the Senate's also moving in this direction, would find these individuals in contempt. Now, the normal way that you would go about it would then be a referral of the case to the Department of Justice, which wouldn't make a lot of sense here.
Mm-hmm.
But there might be a call for a special prosecutor, or they could go directly to court. But one way or the other, it would end up in court, and they would have to decide whether the president's claim of executive privilege can truly be used in this way.
We know that President Clinton claimed executive privilege in the Monica Lewinsky case, and most recently, I think it was invoked when the president and Congress tangled over Vice President Dick Cheney's Energy Task Force. The Supreme Court siding with the White House's claim that Cheney did not have to testify about who was on that task force. But, you know, others have said, gee, that's exactly the reason not to, let this get, take the gloves off this way, because won't that mean months of more trials and speculation about what exactly happened in this prosecutor's case?
Well, it will. That, you know, we could easily have a year of court action here, probably even more than that. So this administration could end before we had a final resolution before the Supreme Court on the question. And that benefits neither side. But many of us were surprised by how hard the president was. Let me try this again. When he drew that line in the sand, I see there I did it. And I don't know if that was scripted or not when he was prompted to ask, are you going to move at all on this? Because usually the way that this happens is that we do have an initial offer by the White House counsel, and there's some give and take. There's some compromise. But the president indicated that he's not going to compromise.
Well, we do hear that members of the House Judiciary Committee have said that negotiations are still underway on which witnesses might appear under which conditions. So that's obviously happening as a backdrop. But as you said, there's this sort of standoff. We have subpoenas. I have executive privilege. Ranking Senate Judiciary Committee member Republican Arlen Specter cautioned against the use of subpoenas and the long legal fight. He said exactly, you know, what we were implying, that, you know, I would prefer to have these interviews in public and on the record with transcripts, but isn't it more important to get the information promptly than go through, you know, maybe years of litigation?
Well, the committees actually have a very compelling argument to make here, because we've already had testimony given to the Congress that the Attorney General thought was misleading. So they have a very credible reason to require the testimony be given under oath. The other problem here is that it's not self-evident that a transcript or oath are so directly linked to executive privilege. When these people speak in any way to members of Congress on these subjects, they're waiving executive privilege. They've crossed that constitutional Rubicon. The business about we don't want a transcript or to be put under oath has very little to do with executive privilege. It has a lot to do with legal tactics and not facing the potential of a perjury charge.
Well, I want to address a couple of things. You said, you know, they have reason perhaps for some suspicion, and those are the emails and documents that have come out that have shown that, in fact, there was White House involvement earlier than Justice Department people had said in this firing of eight prosecutors. But, you know, to the legal protection, the president has said he wants to protect the advice that his then lawyer, Harriet Myers, gave him in private. Isn't that reasonable, or is there a way for her to testify under oath before a committee, and while doing that, still decline to answer any questions that might violate her lawyer-client privilege?
Well, you've exactly put your finger on it, that you can have testimony with some subjects that would not be discussed at the hearing. The problem with the president's position is it's extreme, and I doubt that he would be sustained on the full scope of this claim. Clearly, he's got a good basis on things like Harriet Myers to say, I don't want her talking about it. But once again, there is a sharp contradiction between what the White House has insisted on and what is necessary to protect the privilege. They're more objecting to the transcript and the oath than talking about the subjects. And that makes it a rather curious type of privilege assertion. Now, to be frank, I think a lot of people in the White House are thinking back to the fact that Karl Rove barely avoided indictment the last time he testified under oath.
And this was the Scooter Libby case?
That's right. And I think that is more of a motivating factor than anything with executive privilege, because what I don't understand is it's one thing for him to say, I don't want them discussing these matters with Congress. That's perfectly plausible. But to say, I don't mind them talking on these matters with Congress, but I don't want any transcript or oath that could be used to prosecute them.
Oh. Jonathan Turley, professor of law at George Washington University. Well, we'll just have to keep watching this story as both sides in this battle have drawn a sand in the line. Jonathan, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Take care. Still ahead, an old Victorian play takes on a new look. We'll talk to Duncan Sheik. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, now a little something from our lifestyles department, as if we had one. These days, a lot of busy families, too tired to cook and tired of takeout, are outsourcing the family dinner to personal chefs. There are now about 5,000 personal chefs nationwide. Their numbers are growing. So to find out what this trend is all about, we visited a personal chef at work in a kitchen in Brookline, Massachusetts.
My name is Andrea Silver, and I'm a personal chef. A personal chef has many different clients, and they see these clients come to cook at their houses on a weekly, bi-monthly, monthly, every 3 week basis, and leave food for them in their refrigerator or their freezer for them to have whenever they want to pull those out. A private chef works with one family, typically, and usually cooks the meals right at or before dinner time and usually serves the meals to the client. That's the difference between a private and a personal chef. I have about 7 to 8 clients. They are middle to upper class working people who have the income but don't have the time anymore to cook.
Hi, my name is Amy Blumenthal, and I'm a public relations and marketing consultant. I run my own business, and Andrea Silver is my personal chef. There just wasn't time. I come home from work, I run a business, I work out of my house, so it seems like it would be easy, but when I walk in the door, leave my office at 5 o'clock, 5:01, I turn into mommy. My 2-year-old is running up to me, mommy, mommy, I have to go pick up my older one at school, and a lot of times we were ordering takeout because there's just not enough hours in the day to do it. So we really wanted to have great food that was just there. I could heat it up. It was ready. It was healthy. We're eating many more vegetables, which you don't get with takeout. And it was like, wow, why didn't we think of this sooner? Why hasn't this happened in my life sooner? It's just so awesome.
I made chicken cacciatore with steamed broccoli with garlic lemon breadcrumbs. I made a chicken piccata with artichokes and Kalamata olives and capers. I made a linguine with red clam sauce. And I made a chicken stuffed with cornbread and dried fruit stuffing with the baked acorn squash with brown sugar and butter.
My husband is like, oh, this is great. We kind of joke that, you know, she channels. It's almost like I made it. It's like she channels my cooking and, you know, puts it on the table. And to him, there's no difference. It's like there's great food on the table. It doesn't actually matter who made it.
This is a vegetable moussaka. So it has celery, onion, carrot, portobello mushroom, tomato, cinnamon, oregano. All of this is topped with a Parmesan bechamel sauce.
It's so funny when I hear myself saying that I have a personal chef, I feel a little bit like Oprah. What does that mean, you have a personal chef? It sounds so strange or ostentatious or something. And the truth is, when I really looked at the cost-benefit analysis, economically it actually makes a lot of sense.
The average range is between $200 and $285 from my lowest service to my highest service, and that does not include the cost of groceries. Usually, if I start cooking at 10, usually I'm done at this client's house between 4:30 and 5. I find that it can get lonely cooking by yourself all the time. So I've become an NPR listener. What they did miss from cooking from themselves was the time they spent with their family. So I don't know if they're really missing anything by not cooking for themselves. I think that they're gaining a lot.
Someone comes in and is cooking great food and cleans your kitchen more spotless than when she arrived. It's, you know, it's every woman's fantasy.
Or man's. Sometimes they do the cooking. Have you been to my house? It's like the food fairy. Amy Blumenthal and her family do the eating. Their personal chef, Andrea Silver, does the cooking in Brookline, Massachusetts. You're listening to Here Now. Young, It's Here and Now. Rocker Duncan Sheik has gone from barely breathing.
I am barely breathing, and I can't find the air. Don't know who I'm kidding, imagining you, yeah.
To perhaps breathing a sigh of relief, his music for the Broadway hit Spring Awakening is getting raves.
Or maybe cool to be a little summer wind. Like once through everything and then away again. With the taste of dust in your mouth all day, but no need to know. Like sadness.
Spring Awakening is a story of teenage self-discovery, bursting with despair and driving hormones. Rape, incest, and suicide all make their way into Duncan's score. The New York Times says Broadway may never be the same. The original play was written in Germany by Frank Wedekind in 1891 and was so controversial that it wasn't performed in English for 100 years. Duncan Sheik's new score and the new book and lyrics from Stephen Sater keep Wedekind's angst-driven German schoolboys historically accurate, except for the fact that they occasionally strut the stage like rock stars. The effect is exhilarating, and both Stephen and Duncan, longtime friends, join us now from New York. Welcome.
Thank you.
And Duncan, I love the descriptions I've been reading of your feelings, you know, before you embarked on this project about Broadway musicals, you know, about how, what was it, that somehow people sing at each other? What were your thoughts before starting this about musicals?
Let's just say I wasn't the hugest fan of people singing to each other on stage when, in fact, they should just be kind of talking to each other on stage.
Duncan, do you mean that people really don't sing to each other, chicks and ducks and geese better scurry when I take you out in the Surrey? You don't really?
You know, I have no frame of reference for what you just referred to. So if that's any indication.
Well, you know, there are a lot of people who, I mean, I have a friend who every time I mention Broadway musicals, he sings the long O in Oklahoma. And just, you know, it's unbearable for some people. But but you came up, I guess, Stephen, with your help, there was another way of approaching this. What was your thinking?
My first idea when we talked was that we would take on this play, Spring Awakening. And as Duncan and I talked about how we might address it as a musical, my first thought was that the songs could function as internal monologues. And then we could have we wanted to create something that was at once kind of a great classic play and at the same time could function as a concert.
So you got around this problem that Duncan and other people have of people just singing at each other, you know, I'm leaving now. But instead, what, they'd be singing about their inner thoughts.
In a sense, the songs almost function as the subtext of the scenes you're watching. It's what's unsaid.
Yeah.
If you go to a rock concert today, they're singing about their internal feelings. You know, that's what rock music has become. And so we're just kind of taking that conceit and using it inside this amazing narrative.
Let's listen to a little. This is Touch Me. It's sung by members of the ensemble.
No more weeping anymore. All the in and out your lips, the broken wishes washing with them to shore.
Touch me,
touch me,
all silent,
all silent.
Baby, just
tell me, please, all is forgiven.
Stephen, I'm going to come back to you. The storyline, briefly, is about young people trying to find their way. One couple, you know, finds their way to each other, Melchior and Wendla. But then Moritz, another character, cannot seem to find his way at all. I had read that the story of what happened at Columbine influenced you. Tell me more about that.
I think that the show, based on this, you know, great play from the 1890s, which we've really transformed and changed, touches on a lot of things that still matter to kids today. We're really getting there by going within the kids' feeling about those things. Do you know what I mean? The first feelings of falling in love for the first time, the feelings for Moritz of failing out of school, and for his friends around him of watching a friend flounder and what that's like.
He's the character who commits suicide.
Yeah, he does.
When you've got a musical and you're wanting to appeal to kids and you've got Duncan Sheik writing the music and you've got a character committing suicide, Duncan, are you worried that that romanticizes it?
Oh, no. I mean, no. It's a completely tragic moment in the play, and right before he commits suicide, where he's kind of given a reprieve where he could have chosen to live. And I think everyone in the entire theater is just wishing that he had chosen to go off with this girl, Ilsa, and live his life.
All things he never did are left behind. All the things his mama wished he'd bear in mind, and all his dad had hoped he'd know.
It's a really tragic moment. And, you know, and I think there's a lot of kids who might be feeling those dark feelings, and they'll see the show and hopefully understand that a lot of people go through these dark feelings and you don't necessarily need to take these drastic measures.
You just let him cry, make a man out of him. A shadow passed, a shadow passed, yearning, yearning for the home.
Well, Duncan Sheik, you have written some music for Shakespeare in the Park. You were in theater in high school. How you managed to avoid learning about the Surrey with a fringe on top, we'll never know. But what did that experience of musical theater bring to this production for you?
Nothing. I mean, you know, when Stephen and I set out to do this, you know, I said, I'm happy to do a piece of theater with you, Stephen, but the music needs to be relevant to people of my generation, to younger people. And so when we started writing Spring Awakening songs, I didn't write them in any different way than I wrote a song from my record. Now, since that time, you know, this has been an 8-year-long process. I have a huge amount of appreciation that, you know, for all kinds of musical theater, and I've seen a plethora of amazing shows, and my appreciation for the form has really grown a lot. But initially, when we worked on Spring Awakening on purpose, it was very much like we're writing rock songs, and, you know, we're not going to think about, you know, the history of, well, the recent history of music theater.
Right. No, you didn't sit down and rent Rent or Tommy or any of those pieces to see, you know, what's been done.
No, I mean, we watched musical kind of, you know, cultural artifacts where we felt like people were using music in a really effective way in the context of a story. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't always work.
In a sense, we're bringing a whole new audience back to Broadway. You know, your friend who sighs and rolls his eyes and sings, oh, you know, there's a lot of people who I think would have had no interest in Broadway who are coming to see our show. And I think for people of whatever age experience their own adolescence again, and that moment, that, you know, the pains and joys of that. And at the end, just stand and cheer. Truly and remarkably every evening. And my feeling is it's less just cheering, oh, great show, and more cheering what the show's about, you know, cheering the message and what it's meant to them to watch it.
That's Stephen Sader. He wrote the book and lyrics for Spring Awakening. Duncan Sheik composed the music. A Spring Awakening, now running on Broadway at the Eugene O'Neill Theater. For more or to hear more from the original cast recording, go to our website, here-now.org. Duncan and Stephen, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You know, it occurs to me that today we went from Iggy Pop to Duncan Sheik Pop. What will tomorrow bring? Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Join us again, Here and Now.
No way to handle things. Who made me so sad?
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.